So welcome back to Chapter 24, The Evolution of the Spiritual Man in the Life Divine. When last we gathered, Sri Aurobindo had just closed his discussion of occultism, having first covered religion, then occultism. He next takes up spiritual philosophy as a manner by which the cosmic purpose in the evolving consciousness works itself out in the religious experience of humankind. All are necessary. These first three, religion, occultism, and philosophy, are supports and means by which the emerging consciousness of the human comes into contact really, substantially, with the divine and can explain to itself a growing knowledge and a developing experience. So, while religion and occultism and philosophy have each their own limitations, they have strengths which we can use to aid our growth. So now he takes up, indeed, spiritual philosophy. An intellectual approach to the highest knowledge, the mind's possession of it, is an indispensable aid to this movement of nature in the human being. Ordinarily, on our surface, man's chief instrument of thought and action is the reason, the observing, understanding, and arranging intellect. In any total advance or evolution of the spirit, not only the intuition, inside inner sense, the heart's devotion, a deep and direct life experience of the things of the spirit have to be developed, but the intellect also must be enlightened and satisfied. Our thinking and reflecting mind must be helped to understand, to form a reasoned and systematized idea of the goal, the method, the principles of this highest development and activity of our nature, and the truth of all that lies behind it. Spiritual realization and experience. An intuitive and direct knowledge, a growth of inner consciousness, a growth of the soul and of an intimate soul perception, soul vision, and a soul sense are indeed the proper means of this evolution. But the support of the reflective and critical reason is also of great importance. If many can dispense with it, because they have a vivid and direct contact with inner realities and are satisfied with experience and insight, yet in the whole movement it is indispensable. If the supreme truth is a spiritual reality, then the intellect of man needs to know what is the nature of that original truth and the principle of its relations to the rest of existence, to ourselves and the universe. The intellect is not capable by itself of bringing us into touch with the concrete spiritual reality, but it can help by a mental formulation of the truth of the spirit, which explains it to the mind and can be applied even in the more direct seeking. This help is of a capital importance. So no doubt, to come into contact, to come into mergence with the divine self, with the Atman, to experience an intuitive and direct knowledge, in other words, to come in into the ken of the higher consciousness, to come to know the soul, how it knows the world, its tact upon the world, all of these things are the real substance of the effort. But we have to be able to formulate it in a way that satisfies and engages the mind so that it continues to participate in the evolution. It isn't sufficient for us to gain access to the spirit and drop all the members that we have so sedulously evolved over eons, but they must come with us, which means the mind must know and understand in the way that it can. Our thinking mind is concerned mainly with the statement of general spiritual truth, the logic of its absolute and the logic of its relativities, how they stand to each other or lead to each other, and what are the mental consequences of the spiritual theorem of existence. But besides this understanding and intellectual statement, which is its principal right and share, the intellect seeks to exercise a critical control. It may admit the ecstatic or other concrete spiritual experiences, but its demand is to know on what sure and well-ordered truths of being they are founded. Indeed, without such a truth known and verifiable, our reason might find these experiences insecure and unintelligible, might draw back from them as possibly not founded on truth, or else distrust them in their form, if not in their foundation, as affected by an error, even an aberration of the imaginative vital mind, the emotions, the nerves, or the senses. For these might be misled in their passage or transference from the physical and sensible to the invisible into a pursuit of deceiving lights, or at least to a misreception of things valid in themselves, but marred by a wrong or imperfect interpretation of what is experienced, or a confusion and disorder of the true spiritual values. If reason finds itself obliged to admit the dynamics of occultism, there too it will be most concerned with the truth and right system and real significance of the forces that it sees brought into play. It must inquire whether the significance is that which the occultist attaches to it, or something other and perhaps deeper which has been misinterpreted in its essential relations and values, or not given its true place in the whole of experience. For the action of our intellect is primarily the function of understanding, but secondarily, critical and finally organizing, controlling, and formative. So his experience of theosophy perhaps informs some of these latter sentences, and one might think about Rosicrucianism and some of its aberrations as well in that field, and understand that Sri Aurobindo brings to this whole vast array of spiritual and inner experience such a balance, such an integrating comprehension, that every note from every instrument, as long as he is the conductor, is played perfectly. Because his touch is so vast, because it is so deep. Others, they may have an insight, but the grounds upon which they phrase or form their insight has not the philosophic extension, has not the comprehension to justify and sustain itself. And so the wastebasket is filled with, quote, spiritual philosophies that have come and gone, come and gone. And Sri Aurobindo's integral viewpoint continues to forge ahead. The means by which this need can be satisfied, and with which our nature of mind has provided us, is philosophy. And in this field, it must be a spiritual philosophy. Such systems have arisen in numbers in the East. For almost always, wherever there has been a considerable spiritual development, there has arisen from it a philosophy justifying it to the intellect. The method was at first an intuitive seeing and an intuitive expression, as in the fathomless thought and profound language of the Upanishads. But afterwards, there was developed a critical method, a firm system of dialectics, a logical organization. The later philosophies were an intellectual account, for example, the Gita, or a logical justification of what had been found by inner realization, or they provided themselves a mental ground or a systematized method for realization and experience, for example, the yoga philosophy of Patanjali. And I think it's just to illustrate that, let's go back to the start of the chapter and one of the quotations that Sri Aurobindo placed there as a motto. The last one, from the Mundaka Upanishad. He strives by these means and has the knowledge. In him, this spirit, the Atman, enters into its supreme status. Satisfied in knowledge, having built up their spiritual being, the wise Dhira, in union with the spiritual self, reach the omnipresent everywhere and enter into the all. Philosophies, theologies, all manner of things, deep psychologies come from such utterances. This is the language of the Upanishads. So he's just described what the experience of the Upanishads is and how it leads to the intellectual account of the Yoga Sutras as given to us by Patanjali. Now we continue. In the West, where the syncretic tendency of the consciousness was replaced by the analytic and separative, the spiritual urge and the intellectual reason parted company almost at the outset. Philosophy took from the first a turn towards a purely intellectual and ratiocinative explanation of things. A couple of words in there. Syncretic from the Greek means confederation or reconciliation. Ratiocinative means reasonable, belonging to the mind. Nevertheless, there were systems like the Pythagorean, Stoic, and Epicurean, which were dynamic not only for thought, but for conduct of life, and developed a discipline, an effort at inner perfection of the being. This reached a higher spiritual plane of knowledge in later Christian or neo-pagan thought structures where East and West met together. But later on, the intellectualization became complete, and the connection of philosophy with life and its energies, or spirit and its dynamism, was either cut or confined to the little that the metaphysical idea can impress on life and action by an abstract and secondary influence. Religion has supported itself in the West not by philosophy, but by a creedal theology. Creedal, from the Latin credo, means I believe. Sometimes, a spiritual philosophy emerges by sheer force of individual genius. But it has not been, as in the East, a necessary adjunct to every considerable line of spiritual experience and endeavor. It has not even been welcomed, we might say. We look at the great examples of Giordano Bruno, or earlier masters. And we see that the West may permit them to formulate a philosophy, but not to champion them outside into practical life. It is true that a philosophic development of spiritual thought is not entirely indispensable, for the truths of spirit can be reached more directly and completely by intuition and by a concrete inner contact. It must also be said that the critical control of the intellect over spiritual experience can be hampering and unreliable, for it is an inferior light turned upon a field of higher illumination. The true controlling power is an inner discrimination, a psychic sense and tact, a superior intervention of guidance from above, or an innate and luminous inner guidance. In other words, viveka in Sanskrit, discrimination. So here, it's an interior or superior kind of touch, something from deep inside or something winging its way to us from above, from a higher consciousness, which brings a tact, a touch, which is unrelated to the senses in a direct way. They are not dependent upon the senses which we contact the world with typically. But still, this line of development too is necessary, because there must be a bridge between the spirit and the intellectual reason. The light of a spiritual, or at least a spiritualized intelligence, is necessary for the fullness of our total inner evolution, and without it, if another deeper guidance is lacking, the inner movement may be erratic and undisciplined, turbid and mixed with unspiritual elements, or one-sided or incomplete in its catholicity. For the transformation of the ignorance into the integral knowledge, the growth in us of a spiritual intelligence ready to receive a higher light and canalize it for all the parts of our nature is an intermediate necessity of great importance. And this, of course, is the role of the book The Life Divine. Based upon Sri Aurobindo's experience, it is a constellation in intellectual form of what his reading of the universe is. This completes this third type of development of the evolving human consciousness through the gates of religion, occultism, and now spiritual philosophy. And now he gets to the real core of it. But none of these three lines of approach can by themselves entirely fulfill the greater and ulterior intention of nature. They cannot create in mental man the spiritual being, unless and until they open the door to spiritual experience. It is only by an inner realization of what these approaches are seeking after, by an overwhelming experience, or by many experiences building up an inner change, by a transmutation of the consciousness, by a liberation of the spirit from its present veil of mind, life, and body, that there can emerge the spiritual being. That is the final line of the soul's progress towards which the others are pointing, and when it is ready to disengage itself from the preliminary approaches, then the real work has begun and the turning point of the change is no longer distant. Till then, all that the human mental being has reached is a familiarity with the idea of things beyond him, with the possibility of an otherworldly movement, with the ideal of some ethical perfection. He may have made, too, some contact with greater powers or realities which help his mind or heart or life. A change there may be, but not the transmutation of the mental into the spiritual being. Religion and its thought and ethics and occult mysticism in ancient times produced the priest and the mage, the man of piety, the just man, the man of wisdom, many high points of mental manhood. But it is only after spiritual experience through the heart and mind began that we see arise the saint, the prophet, the rishi, the yogi, the seer, the spiritual sage, and the mystic. And it is the religions in which these types of spiritual manhood came into being that have endured, covered the globe, and given mankind all its spiritual aspiration and culture. When spirituality disengages itself in the consciousness and puts on its distinctive character, it is only at first a small kernel, a growing tendency, an exceptional light of experience amidst the great mass of normal, unenlightened human mind, vitality, physicality, which forms the outer self and engrosses our natural preoccupation. There are tentative beginnings and a slow evolution and hesitating emergence. An earlier first preliminary form of it creates a certain kind of religiosity which is not the pure spiritual temperament, but is of the nature of mind or life, seeking or finding in itself a spiritual support or factor. In this stage, man is mostly preoccupied with the utilization of such contacts as he can get or construct with what is beyond him to help or serve his mental ideas or moral ideals or his vital and physical interests. The true turn to some spiritual change has not come. And this he described when he touched upon the early phases of religion in human life. The first true formations take the shape of a spiritualization of our natural activities. A permeating influence on them or a direction. There is a preparatory influence or influx in some part or tendency of the mind or life, a spiritualized turn of thought with uplifting illuminations, or a spiritualized turn of the emotional or the aesthetic being, a spiritualized ethical formation in the character, a spiritualized urge in some life action or other dynamic vital movement of the nature. An awareness comes, perhaps, of an inner light, of a guidance or a communion, of a greater control than the mind and will to which something in us obeys. But all is not yet recast in the mold of that experience. But when these intuitions and illuminations grow in insistence and canalize themselves, make a strong inner formation and claim to govern the whole life and take over the nature, then there begins the spiritual formation of the being. There emerges the saint, the devotee, the spiritual sage, the seer, the prophet, the servant of God, the soldier of the spirit. All these take their stand on one part of the natural being, lifted up by a spiritual light, power, or ecstasy. The sage and seer live in the spiritual mind, power, or ecstasy. Pardon me. The sage and the seer the sage and seer live in the spiritual mind, Their thought or their vision is governed and molded by an inner or a greater divine light of knowledge. The devotee lives in the spiritual aspiration of the heart, its self-offering and its seeking. The saint is moved by the awakened psychic being in the inner heart, grown powerful to govern the emotional and vital being. The others stand in the vital kinetic nature, driven by a higher spiritual energy and turned by it towards an inspired action, a God-given work or mission, the service of some divine power, idea, or ideal. The last or highest emergence is the liberated man who has realized the self and spirit within him, entered into the cosmic consciousness, passed into union with the eternal, and so far as he still accepts life and action, acts by the light and energy of the power within him, working through his human instruments of nature. The largest formulation of this spiritual change and achievement is a total liberation of soul, mind, heart, and action, a casting of them all into the sense of the cosmic self and the divine reality. And he notes, this is the essence of the spiritual ideal and realization held before us by the Gita. The spiritual evolution of the individual has then found its way and thrown up its range of Himalayan eminences and its peaks of highest nature. Beyond this height and largeness, there opens only the supramental ascent, or the incommunicable transcendence. So thrown into active mold, these mighty realizations of the transcendence of the cosmic change and dynamize the terms of our natural being, and all move forward together. He has noted the Tri Marga, the threefold path of the Gita, but he might also have called into this provisionally the tantric field, which aims not only at the liberation of the consciousness and the divinization of the inner parts of our being, but insist also on the change of the structure of our physical life, our emotional life, our intelligent, intellectual life, and then extended more broadly into the community as a whole. Because the tantric doesn't operate in isolation, but operates in a field of communal seeking. There is a family, a kula, of souls gathered together in pursuit of a divine object. And that object, change into the real self. But a change which has not only inner impact, but has outer impact as well. Transformative, in essence. I think this is a good place to pause for this evening. Let me note that next Sunday is the 24th of December. It's Christmas Eve. And so, understanding that obligations exist where attendance would be difficult, I think we'll postpone that session in the Life Divine on the 24th. Those who are in Pensacola will come together and read and meditate if they like. But we will resume on the following Sunday, and I know it's ironic, it's New Year's Eve, and I'm asking some of you to participate with us on New Year's Eve here, after which, of course, in a few hours, we would celebrate with the New Year's Eve meditation, which we have always done here in Pensacola since we had the visit by Sri Impi Pandit and Vasanti Rao, taking us from 1979 into 1980. So we will meet on New Year's Eve to continue our study of the life divine, however few in number we might be. But next Sunday, we won't have the Zoom session. So I wanted to share that with you so you can make any change in your plan that's necessary. So for tonight's reading in Savitri, we're going to Book 1, the Book of Beginnings. This is in Canto 5, the Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. Impassive, he lived immune from earthly hopes, a figure in the ineffable witness's shrine, pacing the vast cathedral of his thoughts, under its arches dim with infinity, and heavenward brooding of invisible wings. A call was on him from intangible heights. Indifferent to the little outpost mind, he dwelt in the wideness of the Eternal's reign. His being now exceeded thinkable space. His boundless thought was neighbor to cosmic sight. A universal light was in his eyes. A golden influx flowed through heart and brain. A force came down into his mortal limbs, a current from eternal seas of bliss. He felt the invasion and the nameless joy. Aware of his occult omnipotent source, allured by the omniscient ecstasy, a living center of the illimitable, widened to equate with the world's circumference, he turned to his immense spiritual fate. Abandoned on a canvas of torn air, a picture lost in far and fading streaks, the earth nature's summits sank below his feet. He climbed to meet the infinite more above. The immobile's ocean silence saw him pass, an arrow leaping through eternity, suddenly shot from the tense bow of time, a ray returning to its parent sun. Opponent of that glory of escape, the black inconscience swung its dragon tail, lashing a slumberous infinite by its force into the deep obscurities of form. Death lay beneath him like a gate of sleep. One pointed to the immaculate delight, questing for God as for a splendid prey, he mounted, burning like a cone of fire. Namaste. Jai Ma.